Welcome to episode 72 of the Introvert Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm Beth Bielow. Happy New Year. We just ushered in 2015, and if all of the intentions shared by my friends and colleagues on Facebook are manifested, it is going to be one spectacular year. For me personally, it's the year my book, The Introvert Entrepreneur, Amplify Your Strengths and Create Success on Your Own Terms, will be published. That will be coming in November. And about the same time, there will be an online course that will give readers an opportunity to explore and implement the concepts in the book. I also expect to do a website refresh and, of course, continue to produce more podcasts that include interviews with interesting and insightful people. What about you? What are you excited to create this year? What do you want more of? What do you want less of? And I'll leave you with one of my favorite questions. What do you want to be celebrating a year from now? Part 1, Initial Insight. A few months ago, I happened upon an image online that has continued to haunt me. I think it was an illustration, and it depicted a hand holding a smartphone. The haunting part was that the hand morphed into the phone through tendons and veins, and the phone became a physical extension of the hand. The image hit a little too close to home. I find myself tethered to my technology, whether it's my laptop, Kindle, or iPhone, for the vast majority of the time. There's a certain amount of being connected that's critical to my work. And I also have an addiction to information and love being able to look up anything with a computer in my pocket. That said, the start of a new year is a natural time to look with fresh eyes at old habits. For me, I'm going to challenge my habits around technology. I recently encountered a book called The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. It's written by Michael Harris. I'm still reading it, but I can already tell that it's going to stay with me just as long as that image of a hand morphed into a phone is going to stay with me. And the bottom line is, it doesn't matter if you are an extrovert who craves connection or an introvert who feels overconnected. The critical thing is to be intentional about how and when you connect with others. Part 2, Shameless Self-Promotion. One of the biggest reasons entrepreneurs come to me about coaching is accountability. They're pros at making big things happen, but also feel that on a day-to-day basis, it's not always easy to set priorities, stay focused, and follow through on everything that needs to be done. I myself have had an accountability partner for more than 3 years now, and it has been one of the most powerful commitments I've made in my business. I've been wanting to take the power of connecting and accountability and offer it to a small group of dedicated, driven, introvert entrepreneurs. In February, I'm launching the Action and Accountability Circle. This group is limited to 5 participants at a time and offers an opportunity to share challenges, establish priorities, and practice self-accountability. We'll talk twice per month and have a private discussion group to stay in touch and accountable in between calls. If you're interested in more information, please visit my website at theintrovertentrepreneur.com/accountability. Part 3, The Conversation. One area I've not explored very much is about raising venture capital. So I'm attempting to start to remedy that through my conversation with Brad Feld, co-founder of Foundry Group. He came to my attention through one of his blog posts. I was particularly intrigued by his personal transparency, as well as his enthusiasm for Kickstarter, which I had recently started poking around in and investing in a few projects that I'm really excited succeeded in raising their funding goals. Our conversation has a lot of twists and turns, and those include talking about his experience with depression, why authenticity is so important for entrepreneurs, and how meditation can help introverts manage their energy. Of course, we also talk a bit about what it takes to successfully raise money from investors. Here's the scoop on Brad. Brad has been an early stage investor and entrepreneur since 1987. Prior to co-founding Foundry Group, he co-founded Mobius Venture Capital, and prior to that, founded Intensity Ventures. Brad is also a co-founder of Techstars. In addition to his investing efforts, Brad has been active with several nonprofit organizations and is currently the chair of the National Center for Women in Information Technology, co-chair of Startup Colorado, and on the board of UP Global. Brad is a nationally recognized speaker on the topics of venture capital investing and entrepreneurship, and writes the widely read blogs Feld Thoughts, Startup Revolution, and Ask the VC. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the Introvert Entrepreneur Podcast. Thanks so much for taking time to chat with us today.
Thanks.
I'd love to start out with asking my guests, what's making you smile today?
Today, I'm sitting in Boulder, Colorado, which is where I live. The best city in the world. And this morning I woke up with my wife, Amy, and took my dog for a walk. So I think the thing that makes me smile is I'm where I want to be with who I want to be with.
What more can we ask for? I want to start out by asking about you as an introvert. How and when did you realize you were an introvert? And how would you say that that knowledge influences your choices?
I probably didn't really realize I was an introvert till my late 20s. You know, growing up, I was always a pretty socially active kid, and I'm still very socially active, but I didn't really get my mind around how to think about extrovert, introvert until I started really feeling tired after these sort of long stretches of intense work. Mm-hmm. And the metaphor I came up with for it was this idea that introverts, if you think of it as a gas tank, when you're with a bunch of other people, introverts' gas tank gets drained. When you're alone, it gets filled. Mm-hmm. And extroverts, the opposite, right? For an extrovert, when you're with a lot of people, your gas tank gets filled, and when you're alone, it gets drained. And, you know, I would constantly be needing these breaks where I was alone or I was with Amy, who was my wife or my partner. And many of those experiences were just like laying on the couch reading a book. Mm-hmm. Or being with her, doing whatever we're doing, but very silent. I spend a lot of time in front of a computer, and I actually found that the being physically disconnected from people, but interacting with them via the computer gave me that kind of break. Mm-hmm. Versus this constantly, you know, being with physically other people. So I probably didn't really get that until my mid to late 20s. And then it really, really rang home for me in my mid 30s. When I went through a pretty depressive episode post 9/11.
Yeah. Yeah. Is your wife an introvert or an extrovert?
Amy's definitely an introvert. And mm-hmm. in fact, my sense is her level of introverted tendency is probably deeper than mine. Mm. You know, a lot of people when they meet me or know me would say, oh, is Brad Feld an introvert or an extrovert? I think a lot of people would say, oh, he's an extrovert.
Sure.
Because I'm very public and very visible and very engaged. And, you know, the explanation of introvert versus extrovert is often confused. I think if people said, you know, is Amy Batchelor an introvert or an extrovert? I think most people would say she's an introvert. You know, she's very capable of being in an extroverted situation, but she loves to be alone. She loves to be with a friend. Mm-hmm. She loves to be in these sort of more inwardly focused, reflective situations.
Yeah. Well, you're providing us a wonderful reminder about how we all fall on a spectrum, and that even when we're, you know, sometimes an introvert can appear a little more extroverted when they're next to someone who is more introverted than they are.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'd underscore, and you know, my own experience, people who are introverted, you know, you have to function in an extroverted environment mm-hmm. on some amount of your time, and vice versa. If you're an extrovert, you know, while it might be torture to sit alone and, you know, really focus and concentrate on something, a fair amount of your work life is going to have that context. So I think the thing that is useful once you know what you are is to build muscle on the other, mm-hmm. not in a way that makes you miserable, but in a way that recognizes that, you know, it is a spectrum. And there's not perfect balance. I'm an introvert, therefore I can't, or I'm an extrovert, therefore I can't. It's more of this is what I like, this is what feeds me, mm-hmm. but I'm willing to put some energy into this other context.
Well, I spent some time on your blog, and you've actually just alluded to it previously, and one particular category jumped out at me, and that was depression. It's not a category you often see on the blog of an entrepreneur. And you recently wrote a post about being really transparent about your own depression and how people have responded to you being so open about it. As an introvert, I don't know if you experience this, but I found sometimes if I'm going through that, a challenging time or a time when I'm feeling depressed, it can be challenging to share that with other people. So in your case, you know, was it challenging? And what was the catalyst that led you to sharing about your experience?
In this particular case, which was first 6 months of 2013, was when I really had this sort of extended depressive episode. It started in the fall of 2012, but it really hit home in January 2013. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that difficult for me to be open about it, because I've spent the last decade of my life being very open about the life of an entrepreneur, the life of a venture capitalist from my frame of reference. And, you know, mm-hmm. much of my writing and blogging has taken that tone. And, you know, when I thought about it intellectually and realized I was depressed, and sort of ask myself the question, do I feel comfortable talking about this? The answer was an immediate yes, because it would feel incredibly inauthentic to me, mm-hmm. given that notion of authenticness and transparency, to not be open about it. Right. And in some ways, the inauthenticity, I knew, again, intellectually, probably not emotionally at the time, but intellectually, I knew that would be a negative reinforcing loop on how I felt. So in some ways, it was a relief to me to just be open about it. I wasn't infatuated with the idea I was depressed. And having been through a couple of other major depressive episodes, I knew that it was incredibly uncomfortable. It was unpleasant. But at the same time, I felt real relief by just being with it, right? Not mm-hmm. fighting it, not pretending like it wasn't going on, not presenting a public persona of, you know, look at me, life is good, while, you know, sort of internally struggling with this depression. So I didn't think about it for, you know, long at all, maybe, you know, seconds, minutes, I don't know. It was, mm-hmm. it wasn't a conscious, like, okay, I'm depressed, let me agonize for a few weeks as to whether I'll be open about this. And in fact, the first post I wrote about it, which I think was in October, November of 2012, and I was just starting to feel the sort of seeds of depression start to sprout. Like it started to come over me. I knew I was exhausted. I was really tired, but I was starting to feel it. Like, I didn't even really think about it. I just wrote, mm-hmm. right? And I got mm-hmm. a bunch of feedback, even from just that writing, saying, hey, you know, a little public feedback, but a lot of private feedback. Hey, if you need anything, I'm here for you. If you don't want to talk about it, I'm here for you. Hey, you know, I see you running yourself down. Take it easy. You know, that kind of, because it was a very lightweight commentary, but I think it was all linked together. Like, I already was comfortable with having a very public persona mm-hmm. that I was generating, and I wasn't trying to curate it in a certain way.
It's yeah.
just what
yeah.
I am. Mm-hmm. And so it just sort of popped out.
What I feel you're demonstrating is the power of being aware of what you value most, and then living by those values and letting those guide choices. And when they are so integrated into who you are, you're not going to agonize over it for weeks and weeks. You're going to take a few minutes or a few seconds and say, okay, so what is authentic? What is transparent? What is true to me? And then you have your decision.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I mean, I've written several posts recently, and one of the posts about mentorship, I'm doing a series from Techstars about how to be an effective mentor. We've got a mentor manifesto with 18 points, and I'm writing about each one of them. You know, the third one is practice what you preach, and I had recently written a post, you know, basically saying, do your words match your actions? It's something mm-hmm. I see within the technology industry, entrepreneurship, venture capital all the time, is that people create for themselves and for their companies a persona, and then their actions don't match it. So you have this huge disconnect between the words and then the fundamental actions. And I think that that's incredibly toxic. It's not just toxic for the business and for what you're trying to accomplish, but I think it's toxic for individuals. Like, you know, the dissonance of trying to portray a certain way of being and then having your way of actually being inconsistent with that over a long period of time is just a bad way to live and exist. I think it emotionally is incredibly hard. I think it creates lots and lots of broken relationships and internal inconsistencies that are very distressing.
Yeah, and exhausting.
Exhausting. Exhausting is a better word than distressing. I was looking for the word distressing was the one, but exhausting is the right one. Like, you know, you're constantly having to present a facade that's yeah. not, you know, to match this set of words that have been created, and it's bullshit. Like, you know, just yeah. be what you are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the whole underpinning message of the introvert entrepreneur. So I'm so glad that you brought that up, because it is about being true to who you are and not trying to, I don't know how you feel about fake it till you make it. Sometimes that rubs me the wrong way because of that. You know, if I really get down to it, it's like, I would rather figure out who I am and try to be as true to that as I can, even if that means a few bumps in the road, and, you know, which it would anyway. So,
well, it's a very interesting cliche. So let's just use that as an example. I use fake it till you make it as a cliche. I actually view that as an extrovert cliche,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's extremely hard for an introvert to do that, to like keep presenting until you become that. That's sort of antithetical to the way of an introvert.
Yeah.
For an extrovert, in a lot of ways, you keep trying stuff and then you become of that, right? Versus right. the introvert, which is, this is what I am and that's what presents. I think that the literal interpretation of fake it till you make it, I despise, right? Like, that's complete inauthenticity. But the cliche mm-hmm. is, I don't know if I'm good at this or not. I'm going to keep trying this. I'm going to keep banging away at this, and I'm going to learn from it. I'm going to try again. I'm going to try again. I'm going to try again. Oh, now I'm good at this. And I actually think that there's some wisdom in that in a certain personality type,
mm-hmm.
right, that's comfortable with this sort of visible effort at something. The introvert will do that exact same thing, but in private, right? It's
yes.
not that you're not going to keep working on something and working on something to try to get good at it, but you're going to do it very quietly. You're going to do it until you feel like you have some level of mastery over it. And again, if you put introvert and extrovert on the spectrum, there's going to be situations as an introvert where you find yourself working on something or trying something publicly that you're not very good at. I don't care whether it's in business or sports or music or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It will be uncomfortable. It will be draining. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't exercise those muscles, right? You should
right.
just recognize that exercising those muscles are exhausting. And when you use up your energy, you have to turn around and rebuild your energy again.
And that brings me to another point that you've mentioned on your blog, and that's about your taking up of meditation. And where I see the connection is that you mentioned that it's not about doing it right, but just about practicing.
Yeah, meditation's been fun for me. At some level, I resisted meditating for a long time because I'm a big runner. So somehow I thought to myself, oh, I'm kind of getting the same thing for meditation as I do when I go running.
Mm-hmm.
My wife meditates, and I have several close friends who meditate, including one, Jerry Colonna, who is an incredibly thoughtful and insightful mm-hmm. friend. And I was talking to Jerry, and he said to me something that sort of stimulated me. You know, in the midst of coming out of this depressive episode, I decided to just try, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried. And the meditating, I used an app called Get Some Headspace. I used another app called Calm. I settled down on Get Some Headspace because I liked the sort of approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a month later, I was doing 10, 15 minutes a day. Maybe by this point, I was doing 20 minutes a day. You know, in a guided meditation with this app on my own rhythm, my own terms. And I realized as part of it, you know, and reinforced very quickly through the guided meditation that the goal was not to get good at this,
mm-hmm.
right? I was not trying to get a gold star. I was not trying to get an award. I was not trying to have mastery over this. And I really settled into this notion of I was just practicing. And so then I was with Jerry and talking about meditation, and this construct came up that the reason it's called a meditation practice is self-referential, right? You're just practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that construct, the notion that I wasn't trying to get good at this. I wasn't trying to win. I wasn't trying to have mastery. I was just practicing. It was just a practice. And that allowed me to, in some ways, incorporate much of what I was getting from the meditation into other things and other ways I thought about stuff. So one of the phrases that I've used in the last 6 months is that I think I approach things with a lot more softness.
Mm.
When I'm meditating, you sort of settle in. You have a soft gaze, you have a soft posture, you let yourself be soft, right,
mm-hmm.
as you practice this. And I find myself applying that construct to extremely stressful situations, right? All of a sudden I'm in conflict or a business deal or something that's not working, and rather than tighten up and like try to machine it into the outcome I want, be soft about it and sort of watch it and don't react to the stuff that causes me to normally react. And, you know, it doesn't mean that there isn't this drive to get to a goal or this ambition to have accomplishment with something, but it allows, I think, for at least me to have a broader experience with it, and especially things that go against the grain of what I'm comfortable with, right? Conflict, mm-hmm. people who I think are being disingenuous, situations where I think somebody in the situation is behaving inappropriately. I don't feel like I have to overmanage to an outcome. Mm-hmm. And instead, I can kind of observe somebody else's behavior and let them just sort of play it out.
Yeah.
And by not trying to do anything and then observe it, the person sort of spun out of control on their own. And the rest of the people in the conversation started to realize that that person was spinning out of control rather than me trying to sort of force it down a particular path. And the end result was a very good resolution, including the person realizing that they'd spun out of control because they didn't get into the defensive posture
as
a result of my interaction. So there's a lot of things like that that comes back to this notion of practice. I don't feel like, okay, I figured out how to do this thing and now I'm good at it. Yeah, it's just like, it's interesting to think with some remove from the context, especially when they're really uncomfortable contexts.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's all about the journey, you know, again, another cliche, all about the journey, not necessarily the destination.
Yeah, it's a super powerful cliche that gets lost, right? I mean, there's a bunch of things that I believe very deeply. This sort of wonderful line I heard is that life is a process of continual oxidation, right? Like we're always in this process of dying, right? Like we eventually die.
Yep.
And as time passes, you know, and then one day, for me at least, when the lights go out, the lights go out. That's my belief system. So you have this finite experience where really you're kind of always working towards the end. Another one that pops up over and over again that I say is that we're all just bags of chemicals. We're different chemicals. Like each person's a different bag of chemicals. And, you know, do you want to end your life a bag of chemicals and a bag of broken glass, right? Every time somebody hugs you, they get cut, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of how sharp and miserable you are. Do you want to recognize that you're a bag of chemicals and let that continue to evolve? So experiencing the journey, you know, the good and the bad, knowing that it has finality at the end, is so much more important than the individual things that you accomplish along the way.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I just really appreciate it. And it's reminding me of something that comes up over and over and over again in my coaching, that meditation can create space for us to be open to the right outcome as opposed to a specific outcome. And by right, I simply mean what's the best thing that could happen as opposed to forcing something, as you were saying.
Yep.
Well, I want to talk for just a couple of minutes about your role as a venture capitalist. I noticed you're a big fan of Kickstarter, and that's, you know, of course, been in the news a lot lately, especially with the potato salad issue. And according to your profile, you've backed more than 75 projects, including tennis ball chairs and documentaries and CDs, children's books and ice cream. So there's this really wide range. What qualities do you believe lead, and this might not even just be Kickstarter, but just in general, when somebody is looking for people to invest in what they're doing, what qualities do you believe lead to a project's success?
Well, let me answer that second. The stuff I back in a lot of ways are very similar to how I think about what I invest in as an angel investor or venture capital investor, which is I'm looking for products that I have affinity for, things that I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
And then people or entrepreneurs who are obsessed about that product, not passionate, obsessed. Like this is the focal point of their, you know, of their energy. For Kickstarter, I mean, you know, some of the ones that I've really enjoyed, I backed a Nikola Tesla statue in that's in Palo Alto now.
Yeah.
And the person who ran that campaign, you know, I have a lot of passion for Tesla. I think Tesla's a fascinating person, you know, and obviously a very inspirational inventor and entrepreneur. And, you know, the person who was doing this, I mean, this was their mission. They were so, it was so important to them that it was very, very easy to back it. I think that, you know, I think that people who really go all in on the idea of this is a project that they really want to get done, it really shows. It shows in the profile. You know, there's a lot of people who come up with stuff, and it's a project, and they sort of view Kickstarter as a vehicle, but it's important to them, but they don't know why. You know, they're doing this thing, but it's not really well conceived. They haven't put the effort, that obsessive energy into conceiving how they're going to do or what they're going to do. And so, you know, to be successful, to come back to your original question, be successful, I think you take it very, very seriously from the perspective of what has to happen here for this to work. Why would people care that I'm doing this? Why would people care about this product? And it's, you know, no different than the classic lean startup stuff, and the idea that when you're creating a product, you're trying to get to product market fit, right? You're trying to create something that people care about. And I think a lot of people come at things from the perspective of, well, I care about it, therefore everybody else should.
Right.
You know, I turn it on its side when you're approaching the Kickstarter campaign. Why will other people care? And then I would construct my awards, you know, the different pricing levels based on that. I'm always kind of amazed when I go on a, you know, something that I'm interested in, and I see that there's a $10 level, a $20 level, a $50 level, a $100 level, a $2,000 level, and a $10,000 level. It's like, well, what about the ones in between? And, you know, I get that, you know, at $10 I get a sticker and I'm just doing something to help you, and at $100 I'm getting your product. But you know, isn't there something else beyond the product that doesn't, you know, cost $10,000 where I can be helpful? So that construction often either turns me on or turns me off as well.
Where do you see the future of this kind of funding going?
I think Kickstarter is an amazing example of what I refer to as product funding, right? It's not company funding. It's not crowdfunding in the equity form that the Jobs Act created. It's much more about somebody who has a product that is getting pre-orders for the product and the product validated by these pre-orders. Very powerful, really cool approach. Then I think you see other equity crowdfunding approaches, and you're starting to see some things such as, you know, AngelList and other sites like that. I think that this phenomena is a very powerful one. I think it's a good one in that what's starting to happen is we're seeing that you don't have this intermediary or these gatekeepers between the product creator and the product consumer. You don't have this friction between having an idea around something and being able to test it and get the idea out there.
Right. It makes me think people, they're voting with their dollars in what they want to see.
Yeah, and you know, look, if you put something up on Kickstarter and nobody cares, then that tells you something.
Exactly.
If you put something up on Kickstarter and 1,000 people, you know, participate in the campaign, that tells you something. But those are good things. And I think the world, I think the world benefits from us using this technology, the web and, you know, the internet, and now applications that essentially Kickstarter has pioneered with this notion of crowdfunding to really engage, you know, what historically might have been something called pre-sales, right? Think about the tickets go on sale today and the pre-sales campaign sells out in an hour. Or you get validation. The tickets go on sale today and the, you know, no tickets ever sell. That model has been around for a while, but it's been very curated and very managed versus what crowdfunding is, which is not curated and managed. It allows the individual who's coming up with the product to go out and do that. I like that a lot.
Yeah. Well, what parting advice would you have for introvert entrepreneurs who feel that they might be struggling to stay authentic in what we were discussing of being a rather extroverted business environment?
I don't know that I agree with the question. Like, I don't think the business environment is extroverted. I think that Susan Cain's book, Quiet, is really useful here, right? I mean, she really talks about, and I think does a good job of talking about how our society generally is biased towards extroverts. But I think that is very much changing at two levels. One is I actually think technology, you know, enables a lot of that shift. And in a fascinating way, you're seeing so many people who are sublimating what was historically extroverted behavior into what I would consider to be introverted behavior. So, you know, all the people talking about what's going on in their life via Facebook, interestingly, it's hard to tell who's extroverts and who's introverts from that. And I think an introvert can have an extroverted persona while maintaining their introverted behavior because they're interacting with a pane of glass rather than interacting with other human beings. So it's starting to get a little confusing when you think about that spectrum. And I think that's accelerating. Like, I think the integration of humans and technologies and the behavior changes as a result of it is pretty remarkable. If you think about kids, right, the extrovert kid is the one who runs around and plays with a bunch of other friends, and the introvert kid is the one who sits in his room and reads. I'll use me as an example. My favorite thing, I was, you know, a good athlete. I played team sports, although I liked individual sports better when I was a kid. But I much, much preferred to lay on the hammock in my backyard and read a book. If the choice was go join a pickup football game or lay on the hammock and read a book, I would rather lay on the hammock and read a book. So all of a sudden, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, get your kids out of the house, don't let them play video games, you know, make them go play with lots of other kids. And there's some things that are wrong with that, right?
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
Well, you know, if your kid is an introvert, that's super exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if a kid is on that end of the spectrum, making sure that your kid has some alone time, has some time to interact, or has some time to be introverted. It'd be interesting if that kid could be introverted but interact with other people using the technology.
Yes.
So I think we have this continual bias. I saw a video the other day where, you know, somebody had sent it around on Facebook where it was, I think, a pretty well done video from somebody basically saying, get out from behind your screen, go live life with other people, make sure you're experiencing life rather than living behind your screen.
Mm-hmm.
But it had some very fundamental misses in it because all of the experiences were group experiences.
Oh,
right?
Great point, yeah.
And all of a sudden you're like, okay, that sounds like a really, like, okay, I get it, but no, I don't want that life. I don't want that life where getting out from behind the screen means I have to spend time with 20 people each time.
Exactly.
Right? You know, how about showing me alone hiking in a mountain, going for a run alone, me as a kid laying in the hammock reading a book instead of playing soccer with my friends? So this notion that somehow our world is this extroverted world and we have to function in it, and then at the other end of the pole, technology is impacting how we interact with each other as human beings, I think they're actually symptoms. They're not root causes, right?
It's
we're reconfiguring how we as humans interact with each other because
yes.
of this introduction of this new medium. I think letting us explore that will fail at a bunch of stuff. There will be a bunch of stupid things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, human beings have addictive behavior is not a new thing. So the, you know, the idea that, you know, we have different kinds of intellectual addictions to our technology or physical addictions to our technology, how is it any different than cigarettes and alcohol and drugs? And like,
yeah,
we're back to chemicals. Like, don't fight that.
Right. Well, and when we're going through some sort of social transition like this, it seems like the pendulum swings wildly one way or the other, and there's always a backlash. So get out from behind your computer and experience life with groups of people strikes me as something of that backlash, and somehow making it wrong that we are embracing technology for certain things. And for some people, it's a huge social outlet, and it's highly satisfying.
Totally agree.
Well, I want to wrap up with a question that I ask all of my guests. And since you are a reader in a hammock, I think you'll appreciate this. If you were granted 3 weeks vacation on Introvert Island and you could only take 3 books with you, what would you take with you and why?
I would tackle a series of books that I have fantasized about but have never committed the time to, which is Neal Stephenson's Baroque Cycle. I'm a big fan of Neal Stephenson. I've read most of his books. You know, so I think Snow Crash is one of the iconic books. I recently read Reamed, which is a really good, fun, interesting book. Diamond Age is always sort of challenging book. But Baroque Cycle is a little different, and it's really, really substantial. Like, I have a number of friends who have read it. The investment they've made in it was a multi-month investment. So I think if I was, you know, alone, and in fact, you know, I'm taking a sabbatical in November for a month with my wife, and we're going far away and disconnecting from the world. So we're having
nice.
Sort of a classic 1 month introvert sabbatical.
Perfect.
And I hadn't thought of it. The only technology I'm bringing, and totally disconnect both, you know, computer and phone, the only technology I'm bringing is my Kindle Paperwhite, and I'm going to have it already loaded with books. And I have a Kindle Paperwhite instead of a Kindle Fire so that when I'm online, I'm not tempted to check the web and read on the when I'm reading. Like, it's a different modality. And I think maybe that's what I'll tackle in that month. I was thinking about maybe reading a bunch of David Foster Wallace, you know, including some stuff I hadn't read. But now that you asked me, what were the 3 books, right? That trilogy sort of jumps out. Maybe I'll try that.
Nice. Oh, perfect. Something to definitely look forward to then, besides just the month off, you know, also digging into some great reading. Well, thank you so much, Brad. I've so appreciated this conversation. And what's the best way for people to connect with you and learn more about you and the things you care about?
My blog is at feld.com. I blog about every day. Twitter at @bfeld, and I tweet lots of thoughts, and I tweet lots of links to stuff that I'm interested in. I'm easy to reach via email, brad@feld.com. Happy to be responsive to folks. And if people are interested, you know, from an investment perspective in the stuff that we do, foundrygroup.com and techstars.com.
Great. Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. My pleasure.
Thanks, Brad.
Part 4, Recap and Resources. Among the insights I took away from this conversation was the connection between authenticity and energy. As Brad reminded us, the dissonance of trying to portray a certain way of being and then having your way of actually being inconsistent with that over a longer period of time is a bad way to live and exist. When we live with dissonance, we drain energy. We drain massive amounts of energy. But when we're resonant, when we're aligned inside and out with our true selves, we find ourselves with energy to spare. I also appreciated Brad's invitation to have a balanced relationship with technology. This goes back to the opening insight that I shared. We struggle with it when we demonize it and make it the bad guy. Instead, especially for introverts, we can have a healthy balance of online, controlled social time that feeds into our real-life relationships. Yes, get out from behind the screen. But it's also okay to enjoy and use your techie tools intentionally. As for resources, Brad mentioned Headspace, which is an awesome meditation app that I've started using and find very beneficial. There are lots of meditation apps available, so do some exploring and see which one is right for you. And if meditation isn't your thing, I invite you to consider other ways to create some headspace for yourself, whether it's getting out in nature more regularly or even establishing a silent zone in your house. One quick announcement before we wrap up. I'm going to be posting an audio version of my blog posts alongside these interview format podcast posts. I hope you enjoy this new addition to the podcast lineup. The first episode is titled The Key to Entrepreneurial Freedom, Catch and Release. You'll find it labeled as episode 71. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Introvert Entrepreneur Podcast. Until we meet again, remember that success is an inside job.